This is Looking Forward, conversations about the future of work, brought to you by MillerKnoll.
Hey, listeners. What do you think of when you hear the term employee well-being? For many of us, that conjures up thoughts of preventative health programs focused on preventing chronic disease, and those are important. But when we zoom out, we can get a much broader perspective on the multifaceted nature of employee well-being and how significantly it impacts all aspects of how businesses operate. We can also consider the role of the physical workplace in improving it. Today, we have two outstanding guests discussing this topic. Andrea Kilgore is People Director at BT Consumer, a large British telecommunications firm. Andrea has deeply considered how she and her organization can play a more impactful role in advancing employee well-being and is active in exploring new, innovative solutions for doing so. Joining Andrea is Gethin Naden, a psychologist who serves as Chief Innovation Officer at workplace experience software provider Benefex. Gethin is widely known across the globe for his insights on employee experience, having authored a best-selling book, A World of Good, Lessons from Around the World in Improving the Employee Experience. He's won a wide variety of awards, including most recently being named UK Mental Health Campaigner of the Year 2023. Today, we'll dive into how each of us can think more broadly and strategically about employee well-being and how we can improve the health of both organizations and businesses as a result. Enjoy this chat with Andrea Kilgore and Gethin Naden. Andrea and Gethin, welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Thank you.
So pleased to have both of you here. Let's start out by having each of you share a little bit about yourselves with our listeners. Andrea, maybe we can start with you.
Of course. Yeah. So thank you so much for having us. My name is Andrea Kilgour. I'm the Director of HR for BT Consumer, based predominantly in the UK, but actually across many countries worldwide, about 130,000 employees. And my job is actually to focus on three brands who are dedicated to customer service in the broadband and mobile, and now emerging into gaming and sort of platform entertainment. So yeah, really exciting place to be, and certainly lots to get on with.
Gethin, you want to share a little bit about yourself?
Hi, thank you for having me on as well. My name is Gethin Naden. I'm Chief Innovation Officer at Benefex. We're a global employee experience technology business, but I'm also an award-winning psychologist and a two-times best-selling author now. I've had various roles in and around working with well-being in particular and employee experience with the UK government on the future of work and the workplace, made a few influencer lists, write for a few magazines and speak at a few conferences and consult and work with customers to try and improve their well-being and employee experiences. And very graciously, one of those customers is Andrea and BT. And so I think together we bring this really unique perspective of kind of the theory and the actual doing the job, which I don't do. I just do the theory stuff.
Well, it is awesome that you two have an existing relationship. And I should also acknowledge, Gethin, that you've participated in MillerKnoll's insight sharing activities several times. So I'm so pleased to have you on the podcast. So thank you both for being here. Today, we're going to dive into the topic of employee well-being, and I'm thrilled that we've got both of you to do it. Gethin, maybe you can just kick us off. Let's just start by talking about maybe some of the things you're seeing in the world. How are employees doing in terms of their overall well-being?
I mean, I think running up to 2023, I think there were two pivotal moments in time that I think have shaped the well-being of probably several generations in the workplace now. I think the 2008 financial crisis and the 2020 COVID pandemic, obviously two big global crises. Both of these events, I think, drove living standards down. They worsened mental health and they kind of upped financial precarity and became kind of commonplace for so many people. And so I think in 2023, people on the whole are struggling more than they have in quite some time. And whilst globally, those kind of common measures of societal advancement like education and water, healthcare, housing, they get better year on year. For those who are lucky enough to be born into advanced economies, our well-being is actually getting worse. And I think for the under 40s in particular, which is now most of the workforce in most countries, they've been at the sharp end of that 2008 financial crisis, which not only impacted their financial standing, but it also impacted how society supports the well-being of people and those individuals. And so just as things looked like they were getting better for this group following the 2008 financial crash, they found themselves again at the sharp end of the COVID pandemic. And so as a result, the under 40s are now the unluckiest generation in history, economically speaking, and the group most likely to be reporting an increase in poor mental health. And again, that is now the average age of the global workforce. That is what the average employee looks like. So I think the compounding of those several generation defining events coming together over the last 15 years or so hampered a lot of progress we made for workplace well-being. And I think in many cases walked that back. You know, we know that equality got worse, financial stability and mental health for millions has got worse. And I think that has led to a pretty significant change in employee attitudes towards employers and their workplace and their role in that. And so the majority now want to work for an organization that prioritizes their well-being. At Benefex, we found that a massive 92% of employees globally say that a commitment to employee well-being is now the number one priority when looking for a new role. So that's a huge shift in attitudes. And I think as a result, we've seen this well-being industry and the workplace well-being industry boom since the pandemic. I suspect we've seen the advance and adoption of workplace well-being by 10 years or more just because of the pandemic. And so now, and hopefully Andrew will agree, in 2023 onwards, I think most HR leaders place employee well-being as a key target for the next kind of 5 years onwards. And I think there's a whole new set of problems that come with all those things I just talked about, which is, you know, what does good look like? Are we making a difference to our people? Is there evidence of efficacy behind some of the most common ways that we support employee well-being? You know, how are we defining well-being? And what is the employer's responsibility? You know, how far does that responsibility reach? And I'm sure we'll come back to some of those things in this discussion.
Andrea, how does that resonate with you? Are these things that you're seeing as well?
Completely. If I think about the real pressures that most of our people who are prepared to talk about will focus on, they are heavily linked to their mental health. They are heavily linked to financial security. And then in that context of society, what do these things mean for them? And therefore, to that last response from Gethin, I think as an HR leader, I have a duty of care. I can't sit there and allow so many things to be going on around me and not notice that they are ultimately impacting the people who are working hard, who are trying their best. And actually, I want them to be their best at work. And therefore, that link for me also between well-being and inclusivity and well-being and leadership all is drawing into a very different place for HR, that I think that we have to seize that moment, but we have to see an integrated approach to all of these things. I always have an analogy of throwing jelly at the wall in different places really isn't going to help here. So you need that fully combined view where you know that each lever you pull has got some kind of different impact on the people who you are serving, yeah? So I think what Gethin's touched on, I imagine people see in every industry and in every walk of life, and just the dynamics of which parts are dialed up and dialed down are a consequence of where you are within that sort of cycle of events. But it's a really pivotal time, I think, for HR and how we respond.
What I appreciate about what both of you are bringing, it's a pretty broad, a more diverse view of what well-being might mean. Maybe I'm looking at it from a distinctly North American perspective, but I think a lot of employers here might think medical well-being, which is so tied to lifestyle. But the things you've mentioned in terms of inclusion, financial stability, represents a broader perspective. Do you think organizations are heading there and embracing it, or is this still somewhat new?
I think probably guessing if I sort of jump in from an employer perspective, we were already doing certain things, but that focus now has really driven us to think, what are the biggest things that make the impact on people? And we're having to listen in a different way. It's where the work that Gethin does and Benefex really helps test all of that agenda. But if I think about what is well-being, which I think is an interesting part of the discussion, Ryan, you know, my definition and the one that I sort of espouse to within the work I do, I see five elements, you know, health itself, but, you know, physical, psychological, emotional. I see security, whether that's financial, emotional, or physical as well. I think the impact of relationships, whether they are within the workplace or in the family or in the broader community, you know, have that impact as well as the environment. And I think that, again, I think you've touched in other conversations in the past about the sort of the fabric of the environment that we're in, but the cultural environment as well and what that means. And then that, how that sort of places out your own purpose. So that final part for me is that purpose, engagement and commitment. And that's why for me as an employer, you know, those things all tie together and I can't control all of them, but I need to be aware of each of them and the dynamics within it. And Gethin, I think that's where, you know, certainly a lot of the work that you focus on makes a big difference.
Yeah, Andrew and I had this conversation many, many times about well-being. We've been sold a false idea of what well-being is. You know, the workplace well-being industry right across the world, not just in the US, is really focused on you are in crisis, and so I will try and get you out of crisis. You know, it's not preventative, it's very reactive. You know, we focus on you've broken your leg, you've developed poor mental health, you know, you're in some kind of debt situation, you're in some kind of crisis, and I'll get you out of that. But it's also this idea that, you know, we have mental health, we have physical health, and nothing else. And as Angela's mentioned, you know, purpose and belonging, the two things that are really, really important to individual well-being inside and outside of the workplace, very rarely get mentioned in the same conversation as well-being. But I think, you know, we have moved further away from, you know, just kind of medical expenses and health insurance being the idea of what workplace well-being is. You know, we now have this vast and compelling evidence to prove the impact that employee well-being has on almost every universal measure of organizational success. And so we can say, I think, with a degree of confidence that when our workplace workforce is well, our profits are higher, our innovation is better, our customer service improves, collaboration is rife, and even shareholder returns are higher. And I think what's changed over the last couple of years is other stakeholders in this mix have started to follow this. So the most obvious one is the money is now following this. So it's now so compelling that 94% of the top 600 invested in the US now say how an organization treats its employees is something they want to see evidence for before they will invest. And we've seen this recently with a group of shareholders writing to Elon Musk and the Tesla board saying, you've got to improve your company culture, otherwise we will not see the financial returns that we want. So investors and shareholders are saying, you've got to look after people because that's a measure of success. And I mean, there's this great quote I've used before at talks where, you know, nobody comes up with a great idea while they're being chased by a lion. And I think when our lives are stressed, when we're dealing with a squeeze in income, worsening mental health, debt, relationship breakdown, you know, all these things that happen to us in life will affect our work. And so we can't stop those things from happening to our people, but we can make sure as employers that we're making sure we aren't adding to that load, first of all, but that in many cases, we can offer enough support that people become more resilient to the bad things that will happen in life and that they recover from setbacks sooner. And I think when we do that, we are investing in our business. And so we've moved way beyond well-being, just being about getting an employee back to their desk and working as soon as possible, which was the reason behind many old common benefits like health insurance and stuff. We know there's a strong relationship between well-being and performance that I don't think is being spoken about enough. You know, it's going to be a core feature of a lot of the talks I do this year, because there seems to be this conflict between productivity and well-being. Like, productivity is a dirty word when it comes to well-being because it conjures images of burning people out and putting too much pressure on them. But there's a really well-evidenced link between those who are healthy and happy and their productivity. Unhealthy people are less productive and less present at work. And again, the evidence to back this up is really compelling. I think, broadly speaking, you know, the lower somebody an employee happiness is, that's systematically associated with lower productivity. Overall life satisfaction shares a significant positive relationship with all these different measures of performance and objective performance ratings. Employees who feel cared for, no surprise, work harder. And we can even see that in high performers. You know, most organizations, high performers produce around 400% or 400% more productive than other employees. They will account for 5% of our people, but 25% of our entire output. And all these great studies that have been spanning, you know, 16 countries over 10 years found that, you know, if you want a high performing team, you have to have high well-being. There's another great study that looked at 1 million soldiers and found that well-being predicted outstanding job performance. So that meant when soldiers were happy and well at work, they found that that was a cause of rather than a consequence of success. So you could create more success in your business by taking care of people. And I mean, for those who are in it, like myself and Andrea, it's pretty obvious, and we've seen the evidence and we see it in practice. But, you know, there are things going on in the world that make us believe not everyone gets this. You know, not everyone really understands that well-being is about investing in our business.
Well, it certainly is intuitive as you frame it that way. If an organization is so critically dependent upon their people for all of their business outcomes, the health and well-being of those people clearly affects all that. But I think for me, the key was hearing both of your perspectives on that broadened definition about well-being. And I love the notion that it's not just a reactive set of considerations, but it's much more proactive. Andrea, you already mentioned that instead of throwing Jell-O at the wall, which, by the way, is a very politically correct way of phrasing that. I love that.
Thank you.
That you start with listening. But tell us a little bit about how you approach well-being at BT Consumer.
Sure. I mean, we have a really simple approach. So again, it's kind of five things. So we think about how do we connect with people? So we really understand what are the types of problems that they may be thinking about and how do we provide provision for them? That could be anything. We then think, though, about that physical element and how do we give people tips, ideas, space to keep active? And again, that could be the brain activity, it could be physical activity, but how do we think on a local and a personal basis about the impact on an individual? We then talk a lot about taking notice, just spot the signs, whether that's in a virtual environment or you notice somebody in the office is quieter that day. You know, there's often behaviors associated with positive or negative forms of well-being, and just knowing where you are on that balance is great. Keeping learning. Now, this is an interesting one, but, you know, for me, something that we talk about, whether it's learning a little bit more about behaviors, cultures, history, or new skills, all of these things keep the mind going in a different way. They offer different endorphins. And as a result of it, your positivity changes. Yeah. So whether it's a bite-sized 5 minutes you tune into or you take on the next degree course, it doesn't matter. Those instances where your mind focuses on something else will really build how you feel and therefore your well-being changes. And the final thing, and probably the one I get the most excited about, it is actually about giving back. So again, if you look at any psychology, the more that you give back to others in whatever form that may be, you are building a different connection. And the act of the connection with somebody else changes your perspective for that time. Yeah. And we do a huge amount. So we do loads of brilliant things with campaigns and peer support and reaching out to families and just genuine talking situations where we get the CEO to talk, how does he feel about, you know, really challenging subjects such as suicide that used to be completely taboo in our workplace. But the most important thing we do is we talk about volunteering. And whether that's a random act of kindness and somebody, you know, personally for me, when I get a bar of chocolate on the desk, it is a fantastic feeling. But those things where we will go out and we will maybe clean a beach together, or we will have time with a residential care home. COVID was a brilliant moment for us where we thought differently about the way we could still volunteer and give back in a way, even though we couldn't connect because we were isolated by a screen, we could still make a difference. So for me, Care Home Companions, which is something that we set up where we actually just gave 15-minute calls to people who were isolated in their residential homes that didn't have access to their families, didn't only make a difference to the people, but it made a difference to us. And what we learned about not only the situation other people were in, but then we could talk to others about the conversation we'd had with Bill or Peggy or whoever it may be, and how that made us feel, actually changed our whole phenomenon through that period. And, you know, for us, volunteering and the way that we've really reached out and given back has probably been the one, three, and most meaningful thing I think we've been able to do around well-being. We do phenomenal things, but for me, that part where it's about what I can do, however small, can help everybody. And I think that's a lovely thing to take away, whatever kind of environment you're working in, whatever situations you have yourself.
And if I can add there, Ryan, you know, this is why I love working with Andrea. She's not talking like most HR people that I work with on a regular basis. We are talking about the links between well-being and altruism and well-being and learning and development. You know, this, as a psychologist, I know the evidence is there to back this stuff up. You know, learning buffers you against poor mental health. You know, there's this old trope that if you want to do something for yourself, do something for somebody else. And again, heavy evidence to back that up. But again, this is not the kind of well-being conversation that most people are having in the workplace, which is linking together all those traditional measures and ideas in workplace well-being, but, you know, things like learning and development and doing stuff for other people and developing that community, which again, I think people forget and has been missed a lot because of the pandemic. You know, we physically drove people apart and we're starting to realize that, you know, actually community and other people is a really important part of our well-being.
Well, you're making me smile, actually. I'm getting energy and inspiration from this. And I should acknowledge that we have a lot of listeners that are in human resources. We've also got many that are associated with physical workplace, and I want to get to that in a bit. But I do have to ask, should we think of employee well-being as an HR thing? If it's impacting the overall business, clearly it's got to be something that everyone makes a priority. But is it HR's primary responsibility in most organizations to develop a strategy?
Well, I think when I did the talk, I've spoken at a couple of different Miller events over the years, and one of the ones I was talking about is, you know, well-being has been given to HR to own. But as I talked about in the event with you guys, you know, workplace well-being has a huge part to play on the physical workplace. And so people in real estate and facilities management are not involved in well-being conversations. And in most organizations, I think they're still grappling with, we have this thing called well-being, and I don't know where to put it. And I have a team over here that's doing health insurance and gym membership. And so maybe I could squeeze it into that team. So sometimes it goes into reward and benefits. And most companies aren't mature enough to have a dedicated well-being team yet. But I mean, from my view, it's everyone's responsibility, no matter what role you play, you know, in the organization. I think, you know, you don't create a culture of well-being unless everyone's on board with that. And certainly those different departments that we've mentioned.
I think we have a role to inspire. I think we have a role to enable and really role model. But to Gethin's point, you know, if I think about those simple things we said about taking notice, connecting, yeah, they're everybody's responsibility as well as should be their joy. We're back together in environments that we were taken away from for so many years. And that I do feel is the real gift actually of well-being and inclusivity. Yeah. It's the smallest conversation, it's the thank you, it's the smile, it's that how are you doing today? And it can be so powerful if you're not in a great place and somebody just reaches out and asks something as simple as that. You don't need the greatest suite of initiatives. You just need a smile, yeah. And so I do think it is on everybody's shoulders. And I appreciate the world is tough, but it's a small thing we can all do.
Well, Gethin, I know you've given specific consideration to how our physical working environments can affect employee well-being. And Andrea, I know you have too. But Gethin, would you mind unpacking some specific ways that our physical environments can positively affect us?
This is the piece I really like talking about at the moment. The couple of talks I've done with Miller over the years have really kind of pushed my thinking further. The most recent one was actually genuinely one of the most favorite talks I've done in recent times, because I was able to think about things a little bit differently and challenge myself. And, you know, I think as we've kind of touched upon, lost in the noise of employee well-being advice is the role that the physical workplace is having on our well-being, whether that is an office, a workstation, a retail location, or the home. You know, very little consideration is given to the well-being impact of the physical workplace, in part because of what we've been talking about, that well-being has largely been seen as HR's problem to solve, and that well-being or well-being strategies don't get co-created between those designing our offices or running our facilities or making broader well-being decisions. So from all the research I've done over the last couple of years and every kind of well-being consultancy session I've ran with lots of global customers and kind of my own meandering experience as well as largely a remote employee for the last decade or so, I think the physical workplace remains a critical part of the employee experience. And I think for me, there's kind of three key reasons why I think that is. First of all, collaborating from different places or collaborating from home is quite difficult to do. Microsoft did some great research recently on 122 billion email exchanges and 2.3 billion meeting interactions. And they found that although their number increased within employees' kind of immediate teams, those close networks during remote work, interactions with those secondary and tertiary networks are shrinking. And so the moments of innovation and cross-pollination were not happening in the same way because people missed those opportunities to get involved in projects on the periphery of what their kind of role was. And so I think the physical workplace is a way of making sure that collaboration happens, you know, and yeah, psychological safety and everything, all the good stuff that comes with that and drives that collaboration has to happen when people are around each other. I think the second one as well, and this is the thing I probably had the most feedback through on social media after I did the Miller talk, was about this idea that actually commuting might have a really important part to play in our well-being. I think the act of traveling to a physical workplace interrupts a routine that actually might have been quite bad for us. And so whilst many people were liberated from really bad commutes during the pandemic, I think they found themselves with a void that they struggled to fill, perhaps even without ever realizing. I think we thought the commute was getting us from A to B, but it might have been doing a lot more for us. And so I think it helped us to decompress from work, to gather our thoughts, to put rest any disagreements or confrontations we might have had at work, to reflect on our achievements of the day, to ruminate about what happened that day and what might be happening the following day. And I think that's really important, not only to our well-being, but our success as employees in that time to think and strategize, as something that I've personally experienced has disappeared with back-to-back Zoom meetings. And you know, the time to just sit down and reflect, which would happen on a train or in a car. And without warning, we took that away from most of our people. And I think the separate thing as well, which isn't really being talked about, is that a commute allowed us to stop something called role spillover. And so this is the idea that you're not taking your work attitude home with you. You know, for many people, if you acted like the manager at home, your life at home is probably going to suffer pretty badly. Your relationship certainly would. And so that commute separates our work personas from our home ones. And, you know, I've certainly started to try and travel more and drive more places because of that period of quiet reflection that only comes with having to control a car and focus on that one grounding exercise where you're doing one thing at once. And then lastly, I think, you know, we've kind of discussed this already, but Angela mentioned it at the start. Social distancing was not very good for our well-being. The more we keep away from other people, the more our well-being is put at risk. In a huge US study from March 2020, those who social distance from others reported an increase in depressive symptoms, generalized anxiety, intrusive thoughts, more stress. And that effect remained when accounting for people's social resources. So the number of people they had in their social network or the quality of those people. And we also saw that again during the pandemic with dementia patients, you know, a group where regular social interaction was really critical to their well-being. For people with dementia, the social distancing measures resulted in a deterioration of physical health. And so I think, you know, we have to bring people together. There's some really important parts to not just organizational success, but employee well-being. You know, the key takeaway from my latest book is, you know, people have always been important to our well-being and they will continue to be. And so if we remove those opportunities of that kind of community well-being at work, we damage ourselves and we damage our businesses.
Maybe from a slightly different reflection point there, but when you talked about the physical space too, you know, as you're creating new workspaces and many, many people going back into the offices are looking at the environment they had and thinking, is this still fit for purpose? What do I need to pull down, change? You know, some of the biggest things that we have really thought hard about are our well-being spaces in the place that is actually safe and accessible? So many people still have a pride about not wanting others to see where they might just be. So where you place those spaces where you can reflect, where it is maybe quieter or darker or softer, is really important, however small that space may be. You know, we've thought really carefully now as we've been creating new workspaces about where do we put the water coolers? Where do we put the canteen spaces? Because actually, if you are drawing people together through the power of food or other forms of social interaction, but you want everybody to be coming from a different place. Again, if it's in a place that is difficult to find, you only go there when you need the time. Yeah. If you see somebody there, you're probably drawn to them. So they are kind of very simple things that we've been doing. But recently as well, with the real awareness for me in terms of reading about different forms of neurodiversity, we've also been looking really critically at where we have what we thought initially was space, you know, that was big and vast. It can be really overwhelming. And if that's the entrance or if that's the environment you're asking somebody to work in, then you need to think about how do you form other space within that that is safer and provides the adjustment that somebody needs to find the right balance for them. And so for me, this piece about physical environment and fabric has probably never been more important and will continue to evolve. We are nowhere near getting it right, but I feel like I'm learning every single day. And the more I, to the point we talked about earlier, Ryan, but the more I learn about inclusivity and I think about all of the aspects of the wonderful people I work with, I start to challenge my thinking all of the time about these things. And so I think it's great to walk back into an environment and think, is this really the best we can make for as many people as possible? And if it's not, it's not always about changing the physical adjustments. It's that you think about one dimensionally. It's about the noise. It's about the lighting. It's about the space. It's about the plants. Yeah, it's about whether you can put, we would maybe have a place for an allotment now outside, yeah, where people can actually go and either spend the time growing things or they can just sit there and hopefully we'll see bees and wildlife and just take the time out. So I think there are a whole host of things within that, as well as, you know, I fully recognize I was awful at playing leader, then putting it down and being mother and putting it down and being dog walker and everything else, yeah. And I'm finding the commute for me is that brilliant divider that enables me to be all of the people I need to be and be the best I can be at them. And it is, it's a sort of a really awakening moment that you think that all of that has been compressed for such a long time. And it will take people different lengths of time to feel that they can adjust because the world isn't quite the one that we used to know. And that's something we need to do more about.
And it's fascinating. You think about, we're talking about the physical workplace, we're talking about well-being, and we're talking about diversity and inclusion. And to kind of borrow a line from Oprah, like, who's having those conversations? Because it's no one's having it, right? There's this really interesting research that's basically saying, if you're a diverse employee, if you're a Black employee in America during the pandemic, you were reporting that you were better off working from home because you experienced less casual racism. Now, you were experiencing less casual racism because you weren't around people as much, and so you weren't experiencing some of those kind of hidden dimensions of racism that exist. But the challenge with that is, if we don't have more of those diverse people physically seen and around each other, that representation doesn't occur, which is a really important part of how we eradicate things like homophobia and racism and sexism. And so you've got this really complex set of things coming together where, you know, you want people to be around others because you want somebody to see that a diverse person is not the stereotype that you might have been brought up to think they were, and to challenge your perceptions of these people. And so, again, there's a role balancing all of these things together in a way that I just don't think people are having many of these conversations, where we're taking those intricate parts and seeing, well, if we put two and two with three, and what does that look like? And how does that kind of change how I might roll out something in the workplace?
It's a major passion of ours as a research team. Inclusive design has been something we've been focused on for about a decade or even longer, but we've talked about it a little bit on this podcast in previous seasons, but I'm thrilled we're talking about it now. And I just want to acknowledge for a second that, Andrea, when you talked about reevaluating fit for purpose, both of you went to the purpose of these spaces being about important personal connection, about promoting well-being at a deeper level, not just the task at hand, which I do think is a philosophical shift that a lot of organizations haven't gotten to yet. The notion that these spaces are for gathering, they are for promoting belonging, they are for fostering community, not just accomplishing whatever might be on someone's calendar or chart of work for that day, is the new remit, I think, in some ways, for making sure these physical environments make sense. I do also just want to acknowledge briefly that the commute and the notion of transitions in the workday has really piqued my curiosity too. We did this study on how people were working from home in 2021. We kind of studied digitally 100 households in 7 countries. And I was noticing that for those folks in the UK that have garden sheds, which for those of us in the rest of the world is like a little home office in your backyard, even what was sometimes called, you know, a 5-meter or a 10-meter commute enabled people to like mentally transition in a way that rolling out of your bed with your phone in your hand and then being at some sort of computer didn't for others. And so I don't know that I've personally dove as far into understanding these transitions as I would like to, but I definitely think there's something there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's Yeah, I've worked remotely, as I mentioned, for kind of 10, 12 years or so now. You know, I think as I got used to this way of working many years before the pandemic hit, you know, it actually became a level playing field for me, because there were meetings where me getting in a car and driving for 3 hours for a 20-minute meeting wasn't worth it. That 20-minute meeting is now almost always on Zoom. So I get involved in more work stuff. But what would be the point in me getting in a car for 3 hours to drive to the office that I work from just to have the same Teams or Zoom meetings? You know, when I do those trips now, it is around collaboration. It's we're sitting people in front of a dry whiteboard. We're doing something socially. The work that people do at home and people do in the workplace, those two things shouldn't compete with each other. We should be trying to find a way where the physical workplace is delivering something you can't get at home. And I think if you look at Google's offices in London, it's a really good example where, you know, over the years, they were giving you nap pods, they were bringing in street food and bringing those into their canteen. And it was all designed around, I can give you all the stuff you get at home in the office. Just stay in the office for as long as you possibly can. And everything we'll give you, you know, you can bring your dog in and you can sleep there and you can, you know, do all these things. If I can now do all my work stuff at home as well, the physical workplace has to become something else. And that physical workplace, as Andrew pointed out as well, is also a third space. You know, could people like BT in the future be saying, look, we've got 500 people working in and around this town. Why don't we just sponsor or build a co-working space? That's not really an official office, but it's a place of gathering. And it almost feels like if we start to think of the office in the same way that you used to think of offsites, you know, if you've got a sales team that used to have a regular catch-up, or if you've, before the pandemic, had a global team where you'd regularly meet up, if you think about those everyday occurrences and you're designing in the same way, you're thinking about, okay, well, it's about bringing the team together. It's about collaboration. It's about that community well-being. It's about getting that psychological safety and that empathy built. You think very differently about what the physical office is for. And, you know, I've been to many MillerKnoll's offices and showrooms. And it is interesting, you know, some of the people I know who work at your organization for many years have been thinking about designing those spaces, even down to how do I create a flow where I can create more of the moments that matter, you know, where people might gather and have a conversation. And that's, you know, people are now scrambling around trying to replicate those moments of casual interaction that people like yourselves have been purposely designing for decades, probably. It's fascinating.
I appreciate that acknowledgement. Let's talk a little bit more about how spaces can kind of speak inclusion and belonging to the people that might enter them. I think, Gethin, you've used the term cues of belonging with us at some point in the past. And I know, Andrea, you talked about, as an example, sometimes a space being really open and busy can also be overwhelming. What are some of the things you might think about in terms of making sure that people, when they enter a space, feel like it's for them, or that they might belong, or that they're not a fish out of water, so to speak?
I think we've been looking at how do we design a whole range of different environments within the one space. And whereas in the past people would have had a permanent desk area, people would have been collectively grouped together as HR or finance, we're now looking and allowing people to work at the places that are best for them. And the types of variety, even in terms of the sizes, the shapes of the desk, some of them are huge, look like big kitchen tables. Some of them are sofas. Some areas have got lots of things that are busy and vibrant and bookshelves around them. And others are just really, really calm. And all of those different considerations, and to the point that Gethin raised there about the journey around as well, you know, we've thought more carefully about, well, where do we walk and what do we pass through? And if I have these kind of concepts in my mind, would this be intimidating? Would this be, you know, challenging? Or actually, would this make me feel more engaged? So I don't believe we're moving as fast as we'd love to, but I think that, again, is this piece of evolution. But I have to say, I'm incredibly proud of the work that we have done. And we've started to always encourage our employees who are in those buildings to give us their feedback as we're building. So we're designing and we're showing them the ideas, and they're looking at the fabrics and they're looking at the colors. And, you know, that's the part where I'm really hopeful that we've learned so much, that going forward, these people may or may not be with us. You know, journeys are different in terms of workplace tenure. However, their thoughts are hopefully the ones that will bring more people in who feel more engaged and more energized by the creations that they see. So it's an interesting time. I just feel that, again, people like yourself with so much knowledge around these things have got a real opportunity to help us all see things differently now.
Well, let me just be affirming for a moment and say that the sheer fact that you're having that dialogue and that you're listening and that you're engaging may in fact be one of those keys to unlocking success, because we've also seen examples of organizations moving towards that variety, which I do think offers a ton of value. But sometimes if you offer it too quickly, there can be a loss of personalization or people have a difficult time navigating that change. We've all heard the stories, legitimate concerns over people losing their individual space and not being able to express their own identities, et cetera. So sometimes I think those, I think you called it more of a gradual transition, are in fact very reasoned, thoughtful transitions, which can be really valuable.
Yeah, I think there's those cues of belonging. You know, I'm sat here now in my home office and I have Ghostbusters, Back to the Future and Star Wars memorabilia kind of everywhere. And, you know, that help, you know, the psychology behind that is creating a space that I'm familiar with things that remind me of maybe a good time in my childhood that kind of reassure me. All of our homes are designed as an extension of our personalities. We put the books that we like, the films we like on our shelves, the posters on the wall of our favorite bands. We do all these things that remind us that you're in a safe space that represents you. Now, it's difficult to do that on scale, right? If you've got 10,000 people working with you or the size of BD, which is huge across all these different countries, you can't put everyone's personality. But as Andrea said, you can involve people in the design so they feel invested in some of that design. They feedback, and so there are cues of belonging. But with everything we've been talking about with the physical workplace now having to work a bit harder and be used for a different purpose, we really need to think about, you know, what does home look like and what does the workplace look like? These might sound like really insignificant, but these cues of belonging that aren't there at home are things like, you know, my kitchen cupboard doesn't have a sign on it saying, wash up your dirty cups after you've used them. But we have that in the workplace. You know, those signs are kind of cues of like, oh, like warning, there's danger here, and there's a fire extinguisher on the wall, and there's a sign saying, wash your hands, and all this kind of stuff. And I'm not saying we should get rid of those, but they remind you you're not at home. They remind you you're not in an environment that you associate with home. And, you know, weirdly, we did this at Benefex a long, long time ago, where we opened a new office, and we did that, you know, beanbags everywhere, lots of sofas, not enough space for people to sit down, with discouraging people sitting in their teams. We did away with the CEO office a long time ago, so the most junior member of staff could find themselves one day hot desking next to the CEO. And what great interactions they would have, and good exposure, and an opportunity to say to the CEO, look, I think this thing's not working. Maybe we want to fix it. And there's a great customer we work with called Cooper Parry in the UK, which are an accountants firm. And if you Google their name and the words like office or office design, they were an accountants firm that went to become one of the best places to work in the UK with a long list of people wanting to work with them. And one of the big things they did was design their boring white collar professional services offices. And they put a swing in place. They put a Starbucks in one of their offices. They designed this and they were like, just because we're an accountants firm, we shouldn't feel like that. Why can't accountants be fun? Why can't we create an environment that, you know, people want to go to the office because the office is actually a more fun and engaging place than home is. And so I don't see why, you know, with a bit of effort, we can't get to that point where most organizations design a place where people are like, you know what, home is not my preferred anymore because this place actually works a lot better for me.
Well, it's interesting. I've not seen much reporting on it, but I've just anecdotally observed several organizations that we work with in industries that were traditionally considered quite hierarchical, intentionally trying to move away from place designs that speak hierarchy. This has been true in some of the clinical medical environments that I'm thinking of, or in investment banking and other financial services. And I don't know that it's for any other reason, but this is a really good reason to make sure that if someone walks in, that hierarchy or that expression of hierarchy isn't intimidating or in some ways marginalizes somebody that might not be as high on the org chart, but is absolutely critical to the organization. Well, awesome. Well, I'm going to put you both on the spot as we move towards a close for a second. I know you're both well-networked and respected in your understanding of employee well-being, but if you had a friend who was a CEO of an organization, became concerned, rightfully so, about the well-being of their employees, how would you counsel them to start? I mean, it can kind of feel like such an like critically important, but also overwhelming topic. Where do you think smart leaders will start the journey in terms of trying to improve the well-being of their employees?
If I could go first, because I think Andrew will probably end this better and give you something to think about, because again, she's actually doing the job. I mean, for all its popularity in snake oil, I think workplace well-being isn't a fad. I think it's a real driver of organizational performance. It's not about eradicating mental health. It's about supporting the lives of our people so that they can be happier and healthier for them and us. And so I think my advice to that person would be tread carefully. Be careful whose advice you buy. Just because you played professional sports or you're a celebrity with a friend who's got poor mental health or has had a diagnosis, that doesn't mean you have the right answer. And again, this is part of this false idea of what workplace well-being is, I think. Follow the evidence. You know, you guys are very evidence-based. Everything I do is very evidence-based. I know Andrew's very evidence-based. Let's prove this stuff works. Don't give in to that commodification of well-being. You won't advance employee well-being by just buying stuff. As we've discussed today, it requires you to think carefully about every touch point you have with an employee and design every experience that you have at work with well-being in mind.
Excellent. Andrea, additional thoughts?
Really simply, I would always ask people, first and foremost, ask the question. And I mean this really seriously, listen to the answer. It may not be the one you're expecting and certainly not the one that you have all of the answers for. And I think with that listening, you can then genuinely design a journey. And that may be very, very small. It may be huge. But take your people on the journey with you. Share each moment and just evolve as you need to do the right things. And I think piece by piece, you will build a brilliant jigsaw that enables everybody to be built in. But it starts from making no assumptions. I think if we evaluate, you know, between Gethin and myself about the journey we've been on together with all of this, the things that I was doing 5 years ago are absolutely not fit for purpose now. They were brilliant at the time, but the whole world has moved on. And without listening to people, I probably would have missed a number of the factors that really make a difference.
What an excellent exhortation for a much more considered, much more empathetic approach to leadership. And I appreciate that built into what you just said is a real focus on being innovative. I know you didn't necessarily use that word, but being able to move beyond those old practices to listen and do new things that are fit for purpose now is a wonderful priority. Well, I'm thankful for you both. I appreciate you spending time with us and our listeners and sharing your insights.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, we could talk about this and we've do quite a lot, but like Andrew says, we challenge each other quite a lot. This is an evolution. You know, what we're talking about now might change. You know, another pandemic will hit, but I mean, the opportunity to have these discussions, and thank you and Milanel for facilitating it, making it happen, we appreciate it.
I appreciate you both.